Yeah, on the
I'm quietly
on the
confident.
Other hand.
And when I say quietly confident, I mean I'm loudly confident.
The Perils of Jeremy Garcia, starring those seven rollicking rescuers, Stuart Langridge, their courageous sound engineer, John O'Bacon, and that villain of villains, Brian Lundig. Welcome to Bad Voltage.
Have you been watching too much Downton Abbey recently or something?
Unfortunately, too much Penelope Pitstop, which is actually way more interesting.
What the heck is a Penelope Pitstop?
How do you not know what Penelope Pitstop is? You had to
I don't understand half the words that are coming out of your mouth, dude. I swear to heavens, you guys do not speak English. That's all I'm saying. This is getting ridiculous.
It's not even... All right. It's American. Anyway.
Well, it is. Not that that makes any sense. But welcome to Bad Voltage.
Welcome
on
to Bad
the
Voltage.
Show today, we're going to be taking a little bit of a trip down memory lane, and we're going to be talking about how each of us got into Linux, how we got started with Linux, and some of the people we'd like to thank for getting us into this as well.
And then we're going to be talking about all the dust up and brouhahas on the Debian side of things over Upstart and Systemd.
In this episode, Brian's going to review the Lenovo Mix 2, which comes with everyone's favorite operating system, Windows 8.1.
And we're going to take a look back at a couple of previous segments and report back on what's been going on with them.
So, the question is, Jeremy.
This is always the question.
What is
the question?
It is the question.
And now, Bad Voltage.
Recently, there's been a lot of discussion going on in the Debian community about moving to a new init system. So, as many of you will know, you have this piece of software that basically starts all the different system services in your computer when it boots up. And in recent years, some distributions have been shipping things like Upstart, and some have been exploring a new one called Systemd. So, Debian has been having a conversation about which one they want to move to. Now, there's been a few different options on the table here. There's Systemd and Upstart. There's OpenRC, whatever the hell that is. The SysV init, and then there's the option of not making a decision and maybe deferring it, whatever else. So this started off in the Debian community, and there's been a massive spat over this with loads of people who know nothing about the topic weighing in. So we thought, we know nothing about the topic, we should weigh in. Now, a little bit of backstory here. So basically what happened is there was a couple of failed ballots. The way Debian works is they have this committee who makes decisions about these kinds of things, and they have ballots. And there's a group of independent people who are on those committees, and they make, you know, they have these votes on what to choose. So there's a couple of failed ballots. Bede El Garbi, who's the DPL, the Debian project leader, asked for a third ballot. From what I can tell, the committee was basically split into two camps. It was between Systemd and Upstart. And Bedell had the casting vote on Systemd, and therefore it's passed. Now, what happened after this was Ian Jackson, who's a longtime Debian contributor, used to work at Canonical as well, expressed concerns about Bedell, saying that...
Wow, that is wording it lightly.
Yeah. Right.
He expressed that, he said, I hereby propose the following TC resolution. The technical committee has lost confidence in the committee's chairman and request that the chairman resign. I will take my ball and I will run off with it.
Nice.
So anyway, there's been lots of this going on. So what do you guys think about this whole situation? I mean, it's been interesting peering into the Debian decision-making process. Some people have been critical of that. But do you think do you think it was the right decision to move to Systemd? And B, how do you feel like they got to it? What do you think about that?
Well, to start with, democracy is messy. And I kind of dig how utterly messy and ridiculous this became. So that's kind of cool. To me, that just says to me that the process is both working and broken at the same time, which is the best way to have it be, in my opinion.
That is one thing interesting about democracy is sometimes when things that don't happen or that you don't like happen democratically, you like it even less because you feel like there's some kind of subversion must have taken place because your correct answer is not the answer that happened, which I always find fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting about this was there was a guy... Russ Albury, I think his name is, posted a message to the Debian committee mailing list, basically summarizing a lot of this stuff. And he wrote a really, really thoughtful post. And one of the things he mentioned was, in many ways, you know, when you see the full extent of how Debbie makes decisions isn't necessarily seen all of the time. So in such divisive scenarios, you have to use that kind of democratic process more. So on one hand, it looks really over the top and kind of unnecessary, but it's good that Debian has this. I mean, this is the way they've been able to make decisions over the years, but it's also been complicating the fact that I think he described it as like, you know, a big ship that's trying to change course and change direction. And Debian's not been able to do that as often because they have some of these decision-making processes in place.
Go ahead, Brian.
No. I was just going to say, I kind of find it funny and fascinating how it almost seems like every week there's yet another story about how someone in the Linux or open source world has a personality and expresses an opinion with personality, and everyone kind of freaks out because that person has a kind of a colorful personality or colorful wording. And I'm just kind of wondering when that's gonna get boring for everyone, or if it's just like a perpetually interesting circus where we can just watch someone posting to a mailing list and say, oh my god, he used an F-bomb, or oh my gosh, he doesn't like one other person and has a personality, right, and opinion. I almost don't even care anymore. Like, if anything, when people like this, or like Linus or Theo Durrat or someone else comes out and says something that's really, really quote unquote outrageous, I kind of almost just like them more for taking a stand and having a personality and not just being a bunch of sheep. So I just kind of dig it, and then I just move on.
I invite you to consider Hello Magazine as an example, which is essentially doing exactly the same thing with famous people. Anything mildly newsworthy gets reported on. Right, it's just the same thing. It's essentially the cult of celebrity.
Right.
Our celebrities are commensurately more minor, but they are nonetheless celebrities.
There was a lot of this in this whole debate, and part of the reason is because it was seen by some as you know, canonical pitted versus other people. So I think it's fairly fair to describe systemd. The concerns there were in Debian were primarily about portability and about upstream being somewhat arrogant in the way they've handled their code base. And then the criticisms towards Upstart was that, you know, it's heavily driven by Canonical, it's under the Canonical contributor agreement, so there's concerns about that, some concerns about the design of Upstart. But on, you know, and there's benefits of both. Like, systemd is seen as being, you know, pretty cross distro, Upstart is seen as being like deeply established in Debian. So there was lots of legitimate technical discussion. The thing that's interesting to me is I know Ian Jackson and I know Bedel Garbi, right? And it amazes me that this mini spat between the two of them even happened. I mean, Ian Jackson is not somebody who can be bought by a company. That's just physically impossible, right? The guy is, by definition, very independent in his perspectives. He worked at Canonical, but he would never ever, I don't believe for a second he would ever unduly let Canonical influence him. And likewise, I don't believe that Bedel Garbi is somebody who people could lose confidence in. The guy's got a very long reputation of being very committed to Debian and free software.
Yeah, so right.
It seemed like the peanut gallery almost kind of bled into the middle of Debian a little bit. And I don't know, maybe that caused some of this.
It's some bleedy freaking peanuts.
I think the people that don't like systemd really are vehement in their dislike, because it's kind of goes against what a lot of people consider the Unix way, I think, right? We're used to small, clearly defined, single-purpose, decoupled utilities that we can pipe together, which is really what the init system is now, but it's really a lot of what Linux is now. And systemd is none of that, right?
No,
it's binary
true.
Logging. It's one kind of monolithic program that takes over a lot of stuff. So I think the discussion became emotional, and a lot of technical discussions, I think, break down when emotions become involved, because you kind of stop being reasonable.
But that's exactly the point. The technical discussion that was had on the Debian Committee mailing list was, in general, a good discussion. It brought out various issues on both sides. That was great. I mean, John, I mentioned Russ Aubrey earlier, and he's been an absolute star during all
that
of this.
That guy's incredible,
reading through, I read a reasonable portion of the discussion, not all of it. I don't pretend to be able to follow all of the technical detail, but Russ has thought about the issue in depth. He's come down in favour of systemd, but he's not in the business of throwing rocks at OpenRC or at Upstart or Assist Vienna or whatever. So right. that's been a very good discussion. Part of the problem is that you've had the people on the technical committee and then wider than that, Debian developers as a whole, most of whom are reasonable people. And then you've got the Peanut Gallery, who are way too busy trying to find reasons to claim that this is canonical buying the whole system or claim that this is GNOME depending on system D and destroying Linux. And that's what's made this such a cause célèbre, right? That it's been picked up by the Peanut Gallery and thus the media.
Well, come on, though. It's so much fun to talk about how Canonical is trying to, like, rule us all like Darth Vader or something like that. That's just fun. we need to do that every week just for our souls, I think.
You see, here's the thing, right?
But you're
no,
right.
You've made my life a lot easier.
No, Brian is right. We need to do it for our souls.
Right. We need to do it for our souls. And when I say our souls, I mean me personally. It makes me smile knowing how hard I make Jono's life. So I'm really good with it.
Well, I'm okay with that. You and everybody else. The thing that's interesting to me is that when you look at the two entrenched camps, like the Upstart camp and the systemd camp, and I'm talking about the people who make this an emotional issue, the criticism on to either side is the same. It's, you know, the criticism from systemd towards, or from people who are in that camp towards Upstart, is that Canonical are controlling and arrogant, and the criticism towards, you know, from the Upstart side of things, is that, and it's usually pretty personalized towards Leonard Puttering, is that he's controlling and arrogant. And what's interesting to me is that both parts are controlling and arrogant, but both parts have also got the wider open source community's interests at heart, just in slightly different ways. The thing to me is that I think the Debian community, this is a brilliant example of the Debian community just doing their thing. Like, they've always been a rock in Linux, and it was just really remarkable to peer into the process.
But
you know, the Peanut Gallery, I've also discovered, by the way, don't like being called the Peanut Gallery, right? So we're going to get some shit about this.
Screw them. They're the Peanut Gallery.
Although I have to say, you mentioned Russ's email to the list, and I think the last three paragraphs of that, everyone in the community should have to read, and every time there's a fracas like this, they should have to read again. I think it's so good. I know we're running a little close on time, but I'm going to read the last three paragraphs because I think they're that good. And he ended with, after, I might say, a very, very long email.
Very long.
This is a lot of text, and thank you for reading this far, but that's because there's a lot of psychology and a lot of nuance here. And a lot of the outside community that I've seen on this discussion, there's been what I think is a failure of empathy. It's great that people get engaged and interested in technical discussions, and I think that's the strength of the open source community. But people should also get engaged and interested in understanding other people and finding ways to work with other people in difficult situations, since at the end of the day, our communities are about people and not software. And to do that, one has to be able to step back from one's own side and put oneself in the other person's shoes and try to understand how they might feel and why they may hold the opinion that they do. Bias and conspiracy are easy explanations to reach for, but I don't think they do justice to the richness and diversity of our community. I think it's too easy to assume that someone who disagrees with you, perhaps very strongly, is somehow unethical. We need to be able to disagree while respecting each other's opinions. And I think that very much sums up how I feel about this discussion and many other, be it Wayland discussions, or there's many discussions where I think we lose the people aspect of that, and it's good to get that reminder. I know it definitely hit home for me.
Thank you, Gandhi. I love tablets. I just love them. I have for years. I love my old Nokia N810, which was a small little guy, and I love my Nexus 7. The ability to have a pocketable, versatile computer with me wherever I go was just too damned handy to pass up. In fact, my Nexus 7 was, for nearly half a year, my primary machine. Sure, I had other computers around, but my little Android-powered beauty was my go-to device for probably 90% of my work. Some folks that claim to be my friends have called me crazy for this, and truth be told, they probably are a little right. But it has worked well for me.
My only complaint really has been the software powering these devices. They tend to be so locked down. I could really use to be able to install and use typical desktop software on them. I'm not terribly worried about how touch-friendly those apps are. I just want the functionality of software like LibreOffice or Inkscape when I'm on the road or on the toilet. So when the new line of Atom-powered 8-inch tablets came out, I was interested. And as luck would have it, I managed to get my hands on the Lenovo Mix 2, spelled with two I's in between an M and an X, which features a quad-core Atom processor, 2 gigs of RAM, 32 gigs of storage, and a crazy nice-looking HD 8-inch screen. Think about this for a second. Quad-core Atom processor. That's an x86 chip, which means, in theory, you could load up the 32-bit version of any Linux distro you like on that tablet. Just imagine an 8-inch tablet powered by KDE 4 or GNOME Shell. Wet dreams, my friend. Wet dreams. There's only one problem. It comes preloaded with Windows 8.1, and what's worse, there are no Linux distros that currently work beyond simply booting on this tablet, or similar tablets from the likes of Dell and whatnot. So I'm stuck with Windows 8.1. Still, worth giving a spin though, right? Boy, howdy is it worth it. True, the Windows 8.1 Metro UI experience is terrible, and I can't emphasize enough how dreadfully bad it is to use, but the ability to run a full installation of LibreOffice on here is, in a word, game-changing for me. But it doesn't stop there. I also dropped a copy of Steam on here and loaded up a few games. Plays them admirably well. To give you an idea of what sort of gaming performance you can expect, imagine a high-end Core 2 Duo desktop. This tablet clocks in that range in performance tests, except it fits in your pocket. This rig, in the end, isn't replacing my Nexus 7, because Android simply remains far more enjoyable to use on a day-to-day basis than Windows 8.1. But when I need to get some graphic design work done, or when I want to run any desktop app, including VirtualBox, when I simply must run Linux, which, by the way, performs quite well, which you might expect from a rig like this, this is a handy-to-have device by my side. Now, the moment OpenSUSE, Fedora, Ubuntu, or the likes get fully working with Wi-Fi sound and all the other goodies on the Mix 2 or any of those other Bay Trail tablets, I may just be tempted to start leaving my Nexus 7 at home.
So overall, Brian, it sounds like it's a pretty cool tablet, but it's not quite there in terms of matching your Nexus 7. Is that right?
Perhaps. I mean, it's from a hardware standpoint, it's radical. I mean, it's awesome. It's like the perfect nerd tablet because it's an x86 desktop computer smashed down. Well, I guess laptop. If you're smashed down into a tablet that actually fits in your pocket, albeit just barely. But it's kind of awesome in that regard. And I've got LibreOffice, I've got Inkscape on there, I've got GIMP on there, I've got all the tools that I'm used to running on there, and that's kind of epically cool that I can take that wherever I go. I've got a little Bluetooth keyboard, I've got a USB mouse that I plug into it, so it becomes a laptop replacement. It's kind of awesome. I just hate that it runs Windows 8.1.
I have to say,
how does LibreOffice work on there, by the way? Sorry, Jeremy.
Fantastically well. I mean, perfectly well. I mean, it's LibreOffice. LibreOffice and OpenOffice ran great on, you know, old Pentium machines, and here we are with a machine that clocks in performance-wise at about a high-end like 3 gigahertz Core 2 Duo in terms of performance, and it's fantastically fast. And the screen is a full HD like 1080p screen. It's beautiful. So I actually can't find anything wrong with this thing from a hardware standpoint, and the fact that I can run those apps is killer. I just really want to be able to throw OpenSUSE or Ubuntu or Fedora on there. I should point out, if you guys look around, if you look at Fedlit, I think is what it's called, you can get images of Fedora to throw on here, but very little, if anything, works. Wi-Fi doesn't work, and sound doesn't work, and there's some problems with, I think, sleep and a few other things. So it's not really a functional thing at this point, but they're at least getting closer.
I think it's impressive that it runs VirtualBox.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. I mean, that's for a tablet to do that.
Crazy good. So I have an old Lenovo S10 3T, which is an older Atom-powered netbook.
I've had, you know, OpenSUSE and GNOME Show running on there for quite some time. It runs well enough. It's, I mean, it's a low-powered little netbook. It's a little $200 rig, but it runs pretty well. It's very usable little GNOME Shelly box. It runs about the same on that physical piece of hardware as it does in VirtualBox on this tablet. The only downside is the battery life. When I'm running VirtualBox with OpenSUSE and GNOME Shell running full screen inside there on the tablet, I get maybe 3 hours of battery life as opposed to about, you know, say eight and a half when I'm not running VirtualBox. So,
oh, wow.
What's the heat like when you're running? I imagine it would kick off some serious heat.
It gets really warm. Oddly enough, I'm assuming this is where the processor is, right up near the camera. It's got a little camera on the back, and it gets really warm in one spot right near the camera. Otherwise, the whole unit still stays, you know, just kind of warm and soothing to the touch.
But getting away from this whole fantastic, it's so brilliant loving that you lot are having.
Like, hell yeah.
What the hell is the point in saying, oh, look, it's x86. That's brilliant. I can run Steam games on it. That's brilliant. What, by touching the screen?
Wow.
Well, actually,
I was going to ask you about this, Brian. Could you use a Bluetooth controller with it
Bluetooth keyboard and I personally have a USB trackball that I like to use. So I use a little USB dongle.
Can
so
you
I plug
hear
it in.
Yourself, you fucking numpty, right?
Yeah.
You're sitting there.
I have to stop you for a minute because what is
you're
a numpty?
You're sitting there with a tablet and saying, look, and I've got a separate keyboard and a separate mouse. What you've done is you bought a laptop and made one out of bits. What's wrong with you?
Essentially.
Why is this cool?
Basically,
a fucking laptop.
Basically, what you have just said is you've made the point that convergence is a terrible idea, and ideas like having a cell phone that also becomes a desktop, like what Canonical is doing, is an absolutely dreadful idea, and that everyone doing it are a bunch of, what was it, numpties? I don't know what a numpty is.
When you unplug all the other parts of the laptop from your tablet,
it's highly usable.
Unless you want to play a game.
Just to put a point on it. So on Steam, I've got games like Civilization 4 and 5 and whatnot. Civilization 4 plays on here perfectly, purely from the touchscreen. It actually plays about as well as an Androidified or iPadified, you know, strategy game would
that's
play.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so, if you're a strategy gamer, actually the touchscreen works perfectly. Now, if you're a Twitch gamer or a first-person shooter gamer, obviously a touchscreen is not going to do the job. I mean, it's just not going to. It's just a stupid idea. But if you're into strategy, loading up some Steam games or doing like Angry Birdsy types games, all of those games obviously will work very well. Very mouse-centric games.
Quick question about the gaming, because I think some of our listeners might like to get one of these, and then when they're on a plane, you know, have a Bluetooth controller or something like that that they can be gaming properly.
For sure.
What's the 3D performance like? I mean, how do 3D Steam games work in it?
Pretty well. So Civilization 4 is the game that I mostly played on this one at this point. It's a 3D game that's, you know, it's one of those, it's a top-down 2D game, but it's all 3D, and the performance is great. I mean, it's, again, it's probably on par with what you'd expect with having, say, a Core 2 Duo with like an integrated like Intel like high-end GMA card. It's not going to be great, but I'd say it's like a mid-range current laptop video card. So it's not too bad.
Gotcha.
Windows ranks it as like a 6 point something or something on the Experience the Windows Awesomeness Index. I don't even know what the hell that number means, but the performance is actually pretty good. The only real downside hardware-wise with this is it runs Windows 8, which means that you only have about 10 gigs to work with after the restore partition and the Windows 8 installation. So until we get a good working Linux version on here, there's not a whole ton of space to work with.
And that's only maritime, right? I mean,
right.
You know, this is Linux we're talking about. It supports everything. So
that's really why I got it.
So it sounds overall you like it.
It's
hardware-wise, it's
awesome.
Good. Software-wise,
yeah, it's cheap. It's cool.
Right now.
So what's the bad voltage verdict?
Well, it's a cool piece of gear. So that means we have to have one.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, would you like to win 5 completely free O'Reilly books of your choosing? Or if you're a runner-up, win 3 completely free O'Reilly books? Well, you can do it with the Bad Voltage Selfie Competition. This is our very, very first competition in the community. This is how it works. So all you need to do is go to community.badvoltage.org, and there is a discussion on that community called the Bad Voltage Selfie Competition. It's pinned, so it's easy to access. Now, on that thread, there is a link to download a PDF poster. And this is basically a poster that says, I love me some bad voltage. All you need to do is to take that PDF and print that poster out, so you've got it on a piece of paper, and then take a picture of yourself holding the piece of paper. Now, we will then judge all of the different entries, and we will judge you on what is most amusing or original, and the winner gets 5 O'Reilly books, and the runner-up gets 3 O'Reilly books. So it's really, really simple. So try to be original. Think creatively. You might want to take your photo in front of a cool building or landmark, maybe strike some kind of amusing pose, or, you know, feel free to mock the Bad Voltage team. It's up to you. Now, there are a couple of rules in how this works. First of all, any sexist and racist and pornographic crap, then obviously you will not be eligible. Also, you've got to make sure that you're visible with the poster. If it was just you or just the poster, then that doesn't really get us anywhere. All the judging decisions are final. Me and the rest of the guys are going to decide on who's the winner. And all of your entries have got to be in by the 25th of March. That's a Tuesday. Tuesday the 25th of March, 2014. So, head over to community.badvoltage.org. Go to the Bad Voltage Selfie Competition discussion. Download the poster. Print it out. Take a picture of yourself with the poster in some kind of amusing capacity, and then link that poster somewhere online in that thread. So you might want to stick it up on Twitter or on Facebook or on Flickr, wherever it might be. Just make sure you stick a link to your picture online in that thread, and you could win 5 O'Reilly books for free, or 3 O'Reilly books for free. We look forward to seeing your entry soon.
All right, guys. All right. So we've been hanging out for how long now? Like a couple of weeks, couple of months? I don't even know. We've been doing this show for a little while. And we're all very Linuxy dudes. So I'm just curious. Yes. I'm curious how we all actually became Linuxy dudes. Because, you know, I mean, different paths probably all brought us to the same place. I'm curious what those paths are. Now, I was going to start out by asking Stuart how he would get there, but I've got a sinking feeling that that would be a dreadfully boring answer. So I was going to ask Jeremy. Jeremy, how did you get started in Linux? What brought you over the Linux world?
You have now set the bar high for my story.
Incredibly
high. Which I fear will be a huge letdown. So
it was probably, dazzle me, my friend.
I will attempt,
not for us.
I will attempt to dazzle all three of you and the listener all at the same time. Probably about 92 or 93, I ended up running a sports card store that was next to, just by chance, one of Buffalo's first ISPs, commercial ISPs, aimed at kind of consumers. And as I was closing the store one day, the guy came out and said that he noticed I left about the time that he needed some help. So I ended up kind of working there for a while, and they used SCO Linux. So probably now into about mid-94, I'd saved up enough money to buy a PC, and I got it from him, and it came with a Chicago, which was the beta of Windows 95. So I ran Chicago for a couple months, but I wanted what I had used at the ISP, so I started looking around for SCO Linux, which was massively expensive, especially considering the age I was at. So I kind of Googled around, and I ended up finding a book with Yggdrasil on it. I dual booted to Yggdrasil for a little while, and I think I moved to Slackware 2.1, and then by the time 3 came out, that's when I kind of moved to Linux full-time. And I've been using Linux full-time on the desktop pretty much ever since then. So unlike most people, I've never even seen most versions of Windows. I think I logged into XP once when I was taking a pen test certification class, but Vista 8.1 and all that, I've never really even seen.
Seriously, you're old school.
Yeah, so you've been using Linux full-time since what, 96 sort of time?
I would say probably mid-95, if I had to guess.
Wow.
Wow, that's crazy.
Just, why haven't you got a beard?
The joys of swap on and swap off.
I was slightly confused here. You ran a store that sold sports cars, but you had to save up for a year to buy a computer.
Sports cards.
Sports cards.
Cards.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah. Big, big, I
you know,
wish.
You know those... Yeah.
I wish it was Maseratis all around, but no, it was not. It was
considerably more nerdy than Jerry Lynch.
Yes.
I thought, wow, it's a guy who sells Ferraris. He had to save up for a computer. How does that work?
Right, I get it. Okay.
That would be considerably more interesting, even.
And Jeremy, what do you use? I mean, what do you use today? Like, what's your distro of choice today?
The desktop I'm using right now is Ubuntu LTS.
Right. And use something else in the service?
So the LQ servers are all RHEL, and most of the other servers I have are either CentOS or Debian.
So gotcha.
You're
pretty diverse then.
I try to kind of check out most distros and see what they're like. I know I don't install many new ones as Brian, but I try to be a little bit varied just so you can kind of see what's going on in the different ecosystems. And, you know, everyone's kind of doing different, interesting things. So I like to be able to at least poke at it a little bit.
Yeah.
Although, as a shout out to Patrick, I will say the first distro I remember saying, like, wow, that works out of the box was definitely Slackware 96. That was the first time.
Rock on.
Because Yggdrasil and even the early Slackware, something invariably, like, it took me 8 days to get Stardex to work or something ridiculous.
That was my first Linux, Slackware 96.
Okay, and that one, actually, I just remember installing it. It was the first one on CD, so you didn't have all the floppies. And I remember thinking, like, oh, this might actually happen. This works. This is great.
I remember the floppies.
that's when Linux sold out, by the way.
So Jono came in around Slackware 96. When you went to Slackware 96, were you immediately a Linuxy guy, or were you just dabbling at that point? Like, what got you to Slackware 96?
I was living at home at the time. I think I was like 18 or 19, and my brother was living in the US, came to stay for a couple of weeks, and I was complaining about Windows, and he said, "Yeah, you should install Linux." I'll never forget him saying, "You should install Linux. Windows is a Mickey Mouse operating system."
nice.
And then I used to work in a bookshop at the time, and I had a 10% discount, and I bought Slackware Unleashed. With my 10% discount, it came with Slackware 96 as a free CD. He installed it on my computer. It literally needed a soldering iron. There was something up with my hard drive. And then he wrote down the username and password for the account that he set up, put it on a post-it note, stuck it to my computer, and then left.
Awesome. So I was...
Windows had gone, and there was just Dark Star login and login details and nothing else. And I used it for about a week, and then I thought, this is just too complicated for me. I've never considered myself particularly technical. And then I reinstalled Windows. But there's something about Linux that really kind of got my brain going. And reading the book, like, the thing that captivated me more than anything was this notion of the community. That's where I got interested in community.
Boring community. Boring.
Yeah. Let's fast forward past this community stuff.
So that was basically it, really. There used to be a place in England called the Linux Emporium. This guy called John Winters used to sell, not John Winters, John, what's
Pinner.
His name? Do you remember Ack? John, no, John Pinner owns it now. It was John Winters. And they used to import Linux CDs from the US from Cheap Bytes, and then, you know, you could get them. And I bought Red Hat 4, I think it was, or 4 or 5. And that was the first one I actually managed to get, like, X up and running and get my modem working. Hooked from then onwards. So.
A Walnut Creek CD-ROM, ironically.
Walnut Creek CD-ROM, and I now live in Walnut Creek.
Yeah. Nice. It's come full circle.
He's not the only way he's come full circle. John O'Bacon, not very technical, and the reason you know that is because he's still logging in with the same post-it note, 18 years
later. Fair.
All right, now, Stu, from what I understand, you kind of got onto the Linux side of things through peer pressure, right? How did that work out?
Tragically, I had little in the way of Linux peers back then. When I went to university, they were all Unix all over the place, and I thought, this is cool. So I spent a while using DOS key to alias LS to DIR, so I could pretend... But I only had a 286.
You, oh my God.
Nice.
What a spanner.
Magnificent champion is what I was.
Did you have a lot of success with the ladies back then?
I was married just after I left university. How long did it take you? So shut up.
yeah, but I've met your ex-wife. So.
And I've been to your ex-university. Yeah, I mean,
I'm kidding.
The machine I had couldn't run Linux. It was 286, so it ran Minix, and then I got a new machine and did Slackware with all the floppy drives, floppy disks and all that kind of thing. And then Debian for years and years and years.
I don't think I've ever actually spoken with someone who used Minix.
Seriously, back in those days, it was at the level where having all your different file systems be, you know, kind of all mounted under one point rather than being separate drives, that felt like I was using Unix then.
Right.
And to be honest with you, in terms of day-to-day use of the thing, you could use, I think Minix is still around.
It was originally built
as kind of a teaching tool for operating systems.
Yeah, it's academic tool, right?
Yeah. But you could use it quite happily. There are like 15 guys out there somewhere going, wow, man, how can we get Wayland to run on Minix? And they're still doing it, really.
Oh, my God. Yeah, hey, that's awesome stuff, man.
Cancer isn't cured.
No, I mean,
Wayland must run on Minix.
Well, I know, exactly. I mean, I like the way Jeremy says that the first thing he ever found to be really stable and just work out of the box was Slackware 96. I think for me that was Ubuntu 12.10. But
well, varying definitions of work out of the box, I guess. It's all about perspective.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I mean, when we started Lug Radio, we spent a while talking, saying, well, yeah, because I think we were all Debian users back then, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it was like, I wish someone would come up with a version of Debian that was, you know, designed for me to use rather than system administrators. And then Ubuntu came along. Whether it succeeded or not is another question. But
I was going to say, maybe someday, Ack, really nice. Maybe someday.
Actually, on a related note, I don't know if you remember this, Ack, but I remember being in your little library thing at your house, and we had a conversation, and we floated the idea of taking Debian and making it easy to use, because there was all the Project Utopia stuff was going on.
Yeah,
at the time,
I remember.
This really easy. And do you remember all the device information files?
FDI files.
FDI files.
If only you had previously been to space, you could have funded that.
Yeah, we floated the idea of starting like the lowest budget canonical you could possibly imagine.
I mean, it doesn't seem that hard as a concept, right? I mean, it's only taken 10 years and hundreds of millions of dollars to get to where it is at the moment. We could have done that. That would have been easy. Oh, wait.
Easily, I'm sure.
Maybe not.
So Brian, how about yourself? How did you get started in this whole Linux
thing?
How did
you get into it, Brian?
Oh, geez. The first Linux I ever used was SUSE 6, and that was, I don't know, late 90s somewhere. So I'm kind of a newcomer compared to you guys. Before that, I was a DOS dude. I used OS 2 for years, and then I spent
OS
about...
OS 2?
Yeah, I was an OS 2 guy for years. And then I was a Mac developer, a Mac-only developer for about a decade. I was actually a Mac guy over at Microsoft for a few years, too. And
really?
I was a Mac guy forever, and I got really royally burned right in my bottom with a red-hot poker by Apple. And I just kind of threw my hands up in the air.
What were the odds?
Yeah, right? And so I said, you know what? Screw it. I'm gonna go full-time Linux instead of just dabbling with it. And at that point, I became a Debian guy and then an Ubuntu guy and then a SUSE guy after that. I guess I still kind of run a little bit of everything. But that's really what did it. I would not be a Linux guy right now, probably. I mean, unless if Apple hadn't been such royal douchebags. Like, that's what really prompted me to look for greener pastures.
Would you get burned by the 9 to OS X transition or something else?
No, I built, so my primary business at the time was building CD burning software for Mac OS X. And Apple, specifically at one of the developer conferences, I was having a discussion with one of their managers. I'm going to do a lot of dot, dot, dots for legal reasons. And then they actually specifically changed some of the APIs that really screwed me over and made it so I just couldn't do what I needed to do to sell my software. And it was just kind of a round robin there of awfulness, into where they kind of just made it so, for no apparent reason, I couldn't make a living doing that anymore.
And the joys of the walled garden.
Yeah, right. So I jumped out and went for somewhere where I had freedom and love and happiness and could prance around in a little dress in a field, and everyone would love me and have flowers in my hair. And Linux obviously was the way to go for that. I mean, I wasn't about to jump over to the Windows side of things since I'd just gotten screwed by a big commercial company. So that's what I went with, and it worked out astoundingly well. Like it was the best transition technically I could have made. It was awesome.
So just to wrap things up as well, I mean, you know, taking a trip down memory lane, I don't know about you guys, but for me, there's always like an individual or a couple of people that kind of trigger these changes in your life. So I'd like to ask each of you guys, let's go around the table. If you could name one or possibly two people that helped you get onto the path that ultimately got you into Linux, who would those people be? Because I think there's always people who influence you in those different ways. Let's start out with Jeremy.
For me, I would say it would definitely be his name was Larry. He was the guy that owned the ISP. I don't know that I would have ever been exposed to SCO, which is right. What led me to Linux. And that I don't think to never have really used Windows is such an atypical experience that I think I could narrow it down to just him.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Larry.
I'm not sure I could name a person. I mean, the close person would be someone like Andy Tannenbaum, who built Minix. When I first started going out there and looking into this stuff, I thought, how do I run this Minix thing? And he built this. He'd built something that I could run on an old machine that I could understand.
What about you, Brian?
I don't know his name per se, but there was this heavy-set, red-headed, bearded fellow who worked at a future shop back in the late 90s who steered me towards that first box of SUSE on the shelf, and he was adamant that I use that over anything else in a very, very intense Kiwi accent. And I don't know his name, but he was awesome, and he still haunts my dreams.
There's two guys I would like to thank because I know that it wasn't, I mean, screw my brother for that post-it note, but there was a guy, I wish I could remember his last name. There was a guy called John who, when I started out, I wanted to meet other Linux people because I didn't know many, there was no one else who was into Linux where I lived. So I set up a website called linuxuk.co.uk. And there was this guy called John who bought the domain for me because back then domains were quite expensive. It was like £200 or £300 to buy a .co.uk domain. And he, you know, I'm 18 years old. He helped me get that domain and helped support the site. But then there was this other guy called Rafiu Fakunal who used to run Exynet Systems, who also contributed towards supporting Linux UK. If it wasn't for those two guys helping to say, you know what, even as a spotty 18-year-old yob living in your mum and dad's house, you know, you can do stuff even as that kid. If it wasn't for those two guys, I wouldn't be working in open source today. So you can hold those two responsible.
I was going to say, now we know who to blame. So you know what I think we should do now, guys? I think we should take maybe a little bit of a recap, a look back at some of the past shows, probably most recent ones, and also we'll get a little comment on the feedback that we've had recently, because I will say the activity in the Bad Voltage community, which is community.badvoltage.org, by the way, has really been on the uptick in the last couple of weeks. There's been significantly more discussion, I think, than there had been, which we really like to see. And I'll start this one off. Last episode, we covered a topic that is really a derisive topic to some, and one that has let's say, a propensity to go off the rails in many discussions. and that is the topic of gun debate.
Stuart. And
the amount of respectful discourse that happened on our forum was truly impressive. There was really no one that got personal. There was people that clearly vehemently took both sides of the debate, but it was a respectful, varied discussion that really kind of makes me proud of the Bad Voltage community.
Truth. The Bad Voltage crew is cool. That.
I thought the same thing. Like, it just, I remember logging in there because I haven't really been involved in some of the post show discussion, a little bit, but not much. And it just blew me away, like, watching, first of all, the people who were engaging in the debate were really going into detail. Like, they were quoting each other's bits and pieces. This is where discourse is quite cool, actually, for having debates, I thought. But just the respect there was remarkable. And it's pretty rare to see that in online debates. So I was the same as you, Jeremy, really proud of our community for handling that so well.
And one further comment on that topic in general, I know one thing for the listeners to keep in mind is we really try to keep the show at a reasonable duration. And because of that, a topic like, gun debate in general, we really, as I kind of said at the beginning of that segment, there's really two almost disparate discussions, and we unfortunately really didn't even broach the second one. So I would say maybe sometime, I would go with sometime during season two, maybe, if there is interest, and let us know if you think there is interest, we could kind of cover the second half of that discussion.
I agree.
So what else do you guys have?
Well, this is an interesting thing. We did a couple of segments about predictions, our predictions for 2014. Now,
we did.
Obviously, if we get to the end of 2014 and your prediction has come true, then you are a glorious victor and you get to lord it over the other three of us, right?
Obviously.
It is.
Yes.
It is only debatably the case that you get to do this lording if the thing you predicted already had come true and you just didn't know about it.
Now, wait a minute.
Give us an example.
What if you didn't know because you are really poorly informed about the world? Does that still count?
I understand your theory.
Now, wait a minute here. If someone says, I think there's this continent called North America over there, do they get credit for thinking it was over there even though because they didn't know? Or do they not get credit because the stupid continent was there already and they should have just known?
In Bad Voltage, as in the Boom. Law, I'm afraid ignorance is no defense.
We are all screwed.
So there are a couple of things. The first thing I wanted to bring up is we had a prediction about 3D printing. Remind me who it was who talked about that.
That was me.
That was Brian.
And it turns out that certainly Currys, one of the major electrical shops in England, have been selling 3D printers for months and months and months now. So it's not clear to me whether Brian gets the credit for predicting this would be the case and they would go mainstream, or gets a full-throated kick in the swingers for predicting something that's already happened.
We should have a vote.
In slightly sunnier news, Jono's prediction about a VR headset has inched a step closer to happening, I think.
Yes.
Although
yes,
there were a lot of yes, maybes, possiblies, and coulds in that article.
Yeah,
that
we're very happy I'm not about. Buying this.
Well, yeah. So the article basically says that somebody heard from somebody at Sony that the Sony's VR headset is in development. In fact, it should have been announced by now, but there were some technical issues, and apparently it's better than the Oculus Rift. Now, to be fair, a lot of the speculation around gaming that has like lots of different people reiterating the same speculation from different angles, a lot of it actually comes true. So
yeah, I'm quietly confident.
And when I say quietly confident, I mean I'm loudly confident.
on the other hand, you have to bear in mind that the gaming community is full of a bunch of people who watch Gabe walk past three red cars and consider this to be evidence that Half-Life 3 is coming out. So,
Half-Life 3 is totally open source
community,
out,
not like that.
Right. Half-Life 3 confirmed. So, I'm not at all convinced by this article. And you have to have it from both Sony and Microsoft. And they have to be on the shelves by the end of the year. But
No. Well, we'll get back to that later on.
Shelves.
Yeah, we didn't say shells. I said announcement from Microsoft.
Well, you snuck that announcement part in at the end, the very end, at the last second. You're like, what I meant was...
Nut up, bacon.
Well,
a deal with it. All right, so we also had, we kicked off the selfie contest, the Bad Voltage selfie contest, where you got to take a picture of yourself with, you can print out a PDF of I Love Me Some Bad Voltage, take a picture of yourself, and you can win some books. We've had a couple of submissions that have already come in. In fact, on a side note, when I was in Orlando last week and I was rooming with Alan Pope, and Alan Pope gave me a laminated version of that very poster. Which was, he said, I got a gift for you. He gave me a laminated version of that and some earplugs. he's like, I snore a little bit. Black Crow, Alistair, I think his name is, he submitted one. John the Nice Guy also submitted one. We had a brilliant one from Sadeon's, where he's chewing on some electrical cable, but it's all to play for. You can win some books, so make sure you get your submissions in. Get some free O'Reilly books.
Rock and roll. And on the gaming side of things, I just want to point out that we now have a Steam community, an official Bad Voltage Steam community that was set
nice.
Up also by Black Crow. Yeah. Black Crow's he's getting involved, that boy. And
some
guy named Dankles, which is a very amusing nickname to me. I like saying Dankles. Set up a Team Fortress 2 server for us. So that's pretty badass too.
By the way, Dankles has just been like in everywhere in those discussions on the forum. I've been noticing like Dankles has been really
right.
Active. Thank
and
you, Dankles.
Every time I see his name, I say out loud, Dankles. and then move right on. It's fantastic.
It sounds like some kind of sex thing.
It sounds exactly like that.
It sounds like something that would hang off your
body. You know what I think of?
I've got a bad case of the dankles.
I think of damp cankles.
Well, yeah. That is delicious,
it is.
Isn't it?
It's so nice.
Wow.
Anyway, it's great.
There we go. So go to community.badvoltage.org. Just one final thing before we wrap up this segment. Jeremy mentioned that we've had a ton of traffic and interest and you know, discussion going on the forum. It's actually been happening so much so that we're going to have to change hosting providers because we're running out of essentially bandwidth and compute time with our current hosting provider. So I want to say a big thank you to Microsoft for sponsoring the show.
But sorry, Microsoft, we're too big for you now.
But yeah, we're just, you know, we're way too big for you right now. So we're going to be moving away from that. So there may be a little bit of downtime when you go to the forum over the next week or so. Hopefully we're trying to get this sorted out before we release this show. But if you go to the Bad Voltage forum and it's down, then rest assured it will be back online soon.
A ringing endorsement of Azure if there ever was one.
Azure's great. It's just that we don't want to pay for it.
Azure is pretty cool.
So thank you, Microsoft. You really helped us out.
And that brings us to the end of this exciting episode of Bad Voltage. I want to thank everyone, each and every one of you, and I mean that personally, for joining us today. It was awesome, and it made me feel good. How about you guys? Do you feel good?
I always feel good, you know?
I have to concur with that.
Good? Why do you feel good, Bacon?
I feel good because I'm in the presence of Brian Lunduke. That's the reason why.
Darn right.
Most people
on
the internet hate him. I quite like him.
Wait a minute.
I could say we are swimming against the tide here somewhere, I have to say.
You can always feel the love here in the Bad Voltage panel.
Yeah. Oh, we are cuddling.
I mean, to be fair, Brian, you're nowhere near as irritating as people say you are.
Right? I mean, people say I'm irritating all the time, and I'm only a little irritating.
I'm looking forward to Brian banning someone from our forum.
No, he didn't.
All right. Do we have anything we need to tell individuals out there about the show right now? What do we need to tell
about
them?
The show?
I was going to say, speaking of the forum, I think, you know, obviously we did this segment, this episode on how we got into Linux. So what I would like to know is, you, the listener, how did you get into Linux? Why don't you head over to community.badvoltage.org and let us know?
Yeah.
I like good that. Idea. Yeah, that was a good one.
See? Jeremy always has
good
ideas.
Pulling his weight once again. Nice.
Yeah.
Nailed it, boy.
I ought to point out, speaking as the involuntary and reluctant Bad Voltage system administrator.
Stop whinging about being by the way, everyone, the entire duration that we've been recording this show is that we're nothing but whinge the entire time. Admittedly, I'm glad I'm not the sysadmin, but that's not
right. So
I will probably regret offering to help as well.
Yeah, so I should shut up if I was you, Bacon. I want to reiterate Jono's point about how we may have some downtime. I hope we will not, but
right,
we might do, so, you know, be prepared.
Eck is moving Bad Voltage community instance to Minix, so that might induce a little downtime.
Brilliant, you see? Love it. All right,
and
well,
on that
let's wrap
note,
it up.
I think
yep.
We hit the stop button.
That was Bad Voltage.
Is that what we say? I don't even know what we say. I just stop recording and smile.